Hi everyone, this is Shai Danon from Israel, from Raising the Frequency, and today I'm really honored and excited to host James Corbett from the Corbett Report. And to be honest, James is like whoever is dealing or researching conspiracies, but not just, but just real journalism, probably came across James Corbett and his website and the Corbett Report. And I think he's doing a great job over the years, very professional, very accurate, and very comprehensive. And for those of you who don't know James, that's a good opportunity to start with. Hi, James, how are you doing?
Well, to be honest, I got a little bit of a cold, so I'm a little bit under the weather, and you'll hear it in my voice, but I'll do my best.
All right. I just to tell the audience, I told James just when we started and do like a quick test, that it's great to hear his voice. Normally I hear you on your videos and stuff you put out there, so it's really good to hear you on my headphones like this and talk to you in private. Today we will talk about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies or cryptocurrency and how it's related to the world monetary system. We will touch on 5G partly, or the digital prison and digital money, obviously. And to be honest, I saw, when was it when you put out the research you've done about Bitcoin and, well, digital money and India and Bill Gates companies? When was it, like a couple of years ago?
It must have been. I can't remember the date on that, yeah. But I'm going to guess it was January 2017.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, I thought something like that. So without further ado, I just throw out a question, especially for Israelis, I think, but not only, obviously. Most people think Bitcoin and cryptocurrency is something great to save us from the monetary system. Give us your angle on it, please, James Corbett.
Well, my angle is nuanced, and perhaps I'm not going to say what you're expecting me to say, because I am not necessarily against the concept of cryptocurrency.
All right.
Depending on how it is rolled out and what cryptocurrency and in what context. So, in order to start this, I'll start with a little quiz for yourself and for anyone who's listening to this. I'm going to read two headlines, and then you're going to tell me whether you think this means that Ben Bernanke, former chairman of the Federal Reserve, is in favor of cryptocurrency or is against cryptocurrency. Headline number one, former chairman of Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, to speak at blockchain conference. And headline number two, Ben Bernanke, Bitcoin has serious problems. So these are two headlines from different times, both about Ben Bernanke. In one, he's going to speak at some blockchain conference, mm-hmm. presumably because he's interested in and promoting the technology. And in another, he's concerned because Bitcoin has serious problems. What does that tell us about his relationship to cryptocurrency?
Well, to be honest,
this is not a rhetorical question. What do you think?
I think he's promoting it.
I think he's promoting a certain idea.
Yes.
And he's trying to obscure another idea. All so right. We have to start ground level. We have to know something about what we're talking about before we can talk about it. So there is, and I think this is a deliberately engineered confusion that at any rate, it certainly plays into the hands of many people who are not so technically savvy. And they just hear these terms and they kind of all get muddled up in a stew and they're all the same thing. So Bitcoin is cryptocurrency, is blockchain. It's all the same. When you say blockchain, I think Bitcoin. Yes. When you say cryptocurrency, I think Bitcoin.
Sure.
And when you say Bitcoin, I guess that's cryptocurrency, blockchain or something. But most people are not able to differentiate those terms and their meanings and why and how they're being deployed. And this is an extremely important point because I did a podcast, I want to say a year or two ago, called The Bitcoin PSYOP. You can look that up, where I talked specifically about this problem. And why is it a problem? It's a problem because we're talking about interrelated but not equivalent technologies and ideas. And when you can lump them all together and say, this is Bitcoin, cryptocurrency and blockchain, and all these words just mean Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. And then we all just talk about Bitcoin as if we know what it means when no one in the conversation actually knows what it means.
Yeah.
Then that is a very dangerous situation, because then it's very easy to take that big basket of ideas and to move that basket in a direction that we do not want. Moving a direction that perhaps the former Federal Reserve chairman would like, but the average free human being would not like. So I bring this up as just an entree into the conversation, and it is important to start differentiating these terms.
Hang on a
And
second, I have this extra sound on your mic, or maybe it's here. I don't know if it's on my side or yours. Sorry for that. Can you
no
say
problem. I will
something?
mute my mic for a second.
Okay, do it. Can you switch it on back home?
Do
Excellent.
you still hear it?
No, that's good. Go on.
All right. Okay. So let's start looking into this. For example, I think the clearest indication of this is the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, which, for people who don't know, is the central bank of central banks. It was founded in the 19, I want to say late 1920s, early 1930s, as part of the whole exchange mechanism that was taking place so Germany could make its reparation payments for World War I. But it became the central institution for the gathering of central bankers around the world, and it still operates in relative secrecy. Their archives are open to researchers and people who are interested as long as it's more than 30 years ago. I mean, you can't look at anything they're talking about today, of course,
Today,
except the things they publish in their white papers and what have you. And it's one of these strange institutions that is its own diplomatic parcel of land. The Basel headquarters is sovereign space that the Swiss authorities can't raid, and all of this. And this is where the bankers go, the
sure.
central bankers of the world go to have their confab and decide where finance is going. So their pronouncements are pretty important from the global financial perspective. And interestingly, they published a white paper recently on central bank cryptocurrencies, which is an interesting, it's actually an
Sorry.
interesting read.
It's an interesting
Now,
phrase. I mean,
it's an interesting phrase, exactly right, because I think, I'm assuming most people who are watching this from the outside and who do have good feelings about Bitcoin or crypto or whatever probably believe it because this is going to be the solution, the answer to central banking. We can get away from the central banking system. So, what are central bank cryptocurrencies? And in this white paper, if you go and read it, they have these ridiculous Venn diagrams that actually make things seem more complicated than before you started looking at them. I mean, it's a bit crazy, but once you sort through it, you start to see the trick they're playing. So let's start from the building blocks of this. We should start by defining blockchain because that's kind of the underlying technology upon which Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies are based. And a blockchain is really nothing more than a cryptographically secured ledger that can be both permissionless and decentralized. Now, this is important, although it sounds like a bunch of jargon and a lot of people's eyes will glaze over, but it's important because throughout history, we have needed record keeping of various sorts, a central bureau of depository of information that we can all trust so that we can do whatever transactions we're doing, whether it's registering land titles or something like a Visa or a PayPal or whatever it is. You need a central institution. Visa will authenticate this card and make the necessary payment and will debit your account or credit your account. I mean, that's seemingly impossible to get rid of. Of course, you need a single central ledger that's going to be controlled by a single authority that will have the authority to approve or disapprove anything that's going on in there. And that's just a fact, right? Well, in the last couple of decades, an incredible breakthrough has occurred in which, no, they've discovered a way in which you can decentralize a ledger. So no single person holds the single authoritative copy of the ledger. It's dispersed out through many, many people all around the world who may not even know each other. And this is important because this is a fundamental building block for the cryptocurrencies that come on top of it. Essentially, for example, Bitcoin, the Bitcoin blockchain is a decentralized ledger that people can participate in. And what happens is when you make a Bitcoin transaction, and this is a very, very broad, low-level explanation. This is not tech-savvy, jargony explanation. So please forgive me, anyone who is a Bitcoin expert who doesn't like the butchery of these analogies, but essentially when
Can you just mute your mic again and do it again?
how's that?
Better.
Maybe I'll even put on my headphones, and that might help. although I don't promise. So when a transaction occurs, someone spends Bitcoin, and someone else receives Bitcoin for some purchase of something. What is happening is that the information of that transaction is being sent out to the network, the Bitcoin network. And these transactions pool up, and there's a big basket of them. And different miners go around and mine. They take some of those transactions, they put them together, and then they try to solve a cryptographic puzzle, which is embedded in the blockchain. And each time there is a new, again, I've already kind of lost it because you have to understand the blockchain is essentially a series of groups of transactions, and each group of transactions is a block, and they are chained to each other via this cryptographic puzzle that is being solved.
Right.
And it's being tuned by the algorithm to be solvable by the advanced computing power that's available on the Bitcoin network every 10 minutes, which means that the cryptographic puzzle is getting more and more and more difficult to solve. I mean, back when Bitcoin first started in 2009, you could run a program on your laptop and mine Bitcoin. At this point, you need entire rooms of servers with specialized, technology to mine
Wow,
Bitcoin. But
wow.
what they're doing
No,
is
hang
solving.
on. Mute. I don't know why it happens. Mute and unmute.
How's that?
Better?
All right. Strange.
Yeah.
Okay, so when one of the people who have taken a group of transactions and solved the cryptographic puzzle, when someone actually solves it, they win, essentially, and their group of transactions gets added to the blockchain as the next block. It's the next group of transactions that are authorized, and that gets dispersed out to the network. Everyone who has the ledger downloads that, and that's the next block in the chain. And the person who won by solving the puzzle, it gets a certain amount of Bitcoin as a prize, essentially. And so that's how the system works. And it's based on this blockchain technology where essentially it is a decentralized ledger.
I
And
have a quick
it can.
question. Quick
Yes.
question. The guy who invented it, I forgot his name, you probably know his name. Was he for real? I mean, is he genuine? Or is he working for someone else behind the scenes that we don't know? I mean,
Excellent question. Who knows?
all right,
I
all
don't
right,
know.
all right.
Satoshi Nakamoto
Yes.
was the name. The name, the pseudonym. I think
Right.
we all assume it's a pseudonym. Although I think a few years ago, it was Wired or one of those types of websites thought they had the scoop. They found him, and it was just some random computer engineer or something who had never even heard of Bitcoin. Like, it was ridiculous.
Yes,
But
yes.
there's been a lot of times when, oh, we found Satoshi Nakamoto. And now there's one particular person in the blockchain space who says that he is or was part of the group that was Satoshi Nakamoto, but it's highly questionable. Anyway, one thing is for certain. Whoever is or was Satoshi Nakamoto, or at least has access to his files, would be able to move some of the original Bitcoin that was mined from the Genesis block, the original transaction. That was, we know that, well, Satoshi Nakamoto controls that, so whoever can move that Bitcoin must be at least in possession of his keys,
Yes.
which we would assume would be highly. But anyway, again, is it a person? Is it a group? Is it the NSA? This is, of course, a very popular conspiracy theory, as you would
Sure.
expect. One piece of that puzzle was a white paper, I believe, from the NSA itself, from the 1990s, talking about cryptographic currency of some sort. I can't remember the name of the white paper. People can look this up fairly easily, I think. But that people point to that and say, look, they were talking about this a decade before Bitcoin, so it must be the NSA. And it certainly could be. I really don't know. One counter to that would be to say that Bitcoin itself operates on an open source network protocol, which is it is constantly being changed and altered, and sometimes that actually causes forks in the blockchain, so that there are actually then two different versions of Bitcoin. There's Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash and Bitcoin BSV. Or SV, and then there's another Bitcoin Gold or something. I mean, there's many different versions of Bitcoin itself that all claim to come from that same original Genesis block. So that makes another layer of confusion to all of this, if all of this wasn't enough. But the point is that this is essentially a system where the system works because there is a prize, essentially, attached to the work that must be done to verify transactions, because it is work. And This is a fundamental point that some proponents of Bitcoin make, is that sometimes people try to separate blockchain from Bitcoin or some type of cryptocurrency and say, look, we can just use a blockchain like this. Well, not in the same way, not really, because without any incentive to actually get people to participate in mining this blockchain, who's going to do it? Who's going to devote entire rooms full of, you know, expensive server equipment or whatever to doing this? No one. There has to be some sort of prize. And so they say, well, that it's kind of the marriage of blockchain technology and a cryptocurrency as a type of reward that is the essential nature of this. But when you see Ben Bernanke going to speak at a blockchain conference, he's not talking about Bitcoin specifically. He's talking about the blockchain technology, which is an aspect of Bitcoin, but it's also an aspect of many other things. And this is where the real poison pill and the power of the poison pill comes in, because we can use this same technology that is open and permissionless, open source network, decentralized, to create a centralized and closed and permissioned blockchain ledger that is controlled by a central authority, like a central bank, that then issues everyone a wallet, for example, and says, okay, here's your wallet, and hey, we'll even give you some whatever Fed coin, and you have this Fed coin now, and you can spend it in, you know, it's electronic and it's instantaneous and there's virtually no fees and blah blah blah. It's great, just like this Bitcoin that you guys are talking about. What's Bitcoin? Let's go with Fed coin. And suddenly you're dealing with something that's a fundamentally different beast, and one that is controlled by the very central banks that Bitcoin was, at least theoretically, according to the white paper, designed to circumvent. Yes. And this is the real poison pill. It's an insidious ploy, essentially. And there's another layer of it, of course, because this is conspiracy land, so there's many, many layers. But but one of them is that Bitcoin Core, the group that controls or commits the vast majority of changes to the open source Bitcoin network protocol, and that is sort of in charge of the direction of Bitcoin to whatever extent anyone can be in charge of a decentralized network. But there is a group, a core group of developers who are the ones that are pushing many of the changes and approving them. And there is a lot of question by a lot of people. Are they in this for the same ideals as Satoshi Nakamoto professed to be involved in the original white paper? And there's many people who say, no, Bitcoin is being steered gradually towards that Fed coin, essentially. So even Bitcoin itself, Bitcoin Core, the Bitcoin that everyone knows as Bitcoin, could be transformed, essentially, into the central banker's tool.
Is he being transformed?
Well, I guess you could argue it's too early to say. I personally think that clearly there are some influences in the Bitcoin community that are pushing it towards some sort of central banking, know your customer, fill out your forms, pay your taxes type of mindset that did not used to be in the cryptocurrency space several years ago. Those people used to be laughed out or thrown out of conferences. Now they seem to be the ones running the conferences.
Right.
A lot.
Yes.
So this is an interesting change.
Since we're already in it, I want the audience to know at least a bit, I mean, to get a glimpse of your research, the research you've done about India and taking out cash money from the system for whatever claims, yes? I mean, you'll say it. And the part that big American, or maybe not only American, companies, as well as Bill Gates, what part they played in India. We're talking about India and cash system in India. What happened there, and how American companies and Bill Gates were involved in this with the Prime Minister of India. And for me, at least, if you can, you know, you'll say if it's true or not. For me, I think the way I see it, that was a pilot for worldwide, maybe a digital money system.
Yes, yes.
You know, this is just a pilot to see how the market react, and it's a pilot on you know, 1.2 billion people. That's a big pilot. I mean, they're doing some pilots in China for other stuff as well, but that we'll keep for another show. So if you can just talk about India, because I think it's a great example, and it gives a glimpse to most people to understand how it works in big markets with big money and big cartels. Go on.
Yes. All right. So we're bringing in a related but not identical theme, idea of digital currency. So for I'll just direct people once again to that BIS white paper on central bank cryptocurrencies, where they delineate all of this. There's, for example, central bank cryptocurrencies, there's decentralized cryptocurrencies, there's digital currencies, which is a different beast altogether. And I think it will not need a lot of elaboration, even for skeptics and anti-conspiracists in the crowd, that we are moving into a cashless society type of world where that is clearly being heavily promoted by a number of different groups for, you can imagine, whatever interests they might have. But we are moving towards the cashless world, and we are being prompted in that direction by a number of powerful individuals, corporations, governments, groups, etc. One example of that occurred in late 2016, when overnight, Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India, came out and said, okay, all those 500 and 1,000 rupee notes that are floating around out there in the Indian economy are now no longer officially recognized. Those are no longer usable. They are no longer spendable. They're not a national currency anymore. So if you have any of them, you have to come to the banks and exchange them for new notes. And this was obviously a pretty big shock to a lot of people, especially in a extremely populous country like India, and obviously affects a lot of people, including people in potentially in locations that do not make it very convenient for them to go to the nearest bank to hand in their bills. But so it's a huge decision to do something like that. And why did Modi want to do this? It's to deal with black money. Black money is a term that they use in India to talk about money that is not officially known about by the government. So basically, people, the equivalent of people storing bills under their mattresses, who knows where they came from, who knows where they're going, you can't track them, you certainly can't tax them. And that is something that the Indian media keeps harping on. It keeps going back to black money. We got to get the black money out because it's affecting politics and it's affecting business, and we need to be able to see and surveil and track everything.
By the way, just to say, it's the same reason or excuse in Israel for
And many other countries, yes, I'm sure. Right. Exactly. I've seen Canadian government documents and many other places that talk about the exact same thing.
Yeah.
We can't surveil it. We can't track it. You know, it could be used for drug money laundering or something like that. I mean, we wouldn't want that unless it's HSBC, in which case we'll give them a slap on the wrist because that's a big major international bank doing drug money laundering.
Yeah.
Look it up. Real story. Anyway, so this is the ostensible reason for this. But what is the real reason? Well, I think one angle into this. I mean, first of all, on its face, yes, I think I agree. They are doing this because they want to be able to surveil and track all of the money in existence. And the best way to do this is to transition India into a more cashless society, which in the wake of this demonetization of the 500 and 1,000 rupee note, wouldn't you know it, all these cashless payment systems are taking off and getting big injections of capital and starting networks. And more people in India are going, if not cashless, at least using cashless payment systems. So mission accomplished, essentially. And this represents ultimate control by the central bank, by the government, by the authorities over its population. This has to be understood in the context of India and its Aadhaar system, which is one of the most momentous, ridiculous, ambitious projects unleashed on the world in the past couple of decades, which is to electronically fingerprint and iris scan, and there might have been some other biometric details, every single person in India. We're talking about a billion or so people, give or take.
What is Aadhaar system? You said something.
Yes, that's the name of the system. It's Aadhaar, and I'm sure it means something in some native language,
leave it,
but
don't
do not know.
Don't look it up now. It's all right. Go on.
I got to look it up now. You can't let me,
yeah, but you
let
flow,
me not
man.
Go. No.
You know,
well, anyway. Yeah. All right. Anyway, it is the name of the electronic identification system that India has brought in.
All right.
And now they are starting to wed that system to tax payments, so you will now need the Aadhaar in order to file your taxes, and of course you need to file your taxes to be, and so it's this basically incredible, I don't want to say prison because that will prejudge what is going on, but certainly a ring of control and authority around every single person in India, where at one point, I mean, they didn't even know exactly how many people are living out in the middle of nowhere and whatever. But at this point, in order to transact, you're increasingly going to need to be on the Aadhaar system. So you're going to have to give the government your biometric details. What could go wrong, except for the fact that it already has gone wrong spectacularly on multiple occasions? There have been multiple hacks and breaches and leaks of biometric information. And The funny thing about biometrics, fingerprints and iris scans and these types of things, face scans, you can change a password if it gets hacked or broken into. You can't change your fingerprints. So this is orders of magnitude more privacy invading when this type of thing gets leaked or hacked. But that's even kind of the limited hangout of all of this. Oh, there could be leaks or hacks. Yes, it is a security risk. But more to the point, why would we trust the government with this most sensitive data about who we are and how to identify us, as this will inevitably get linked into the facial recognition scanning camera grid that's going up around the world. Maybe not so dense in India right now, but we see how this is happening in China, where not only is this system being installed, but now it's being tied to social credit
There's
scores so
another
that.
pilot that is happening in China to see how it goes to implement
Yes.
this system.
Yes, and for people who don't know about that, the essential idea is if you're a good boy or a good girl and you do everything good that the government tells you to do, then your score will go up. And if you do bad things, your score will go down, which is extremely dangerous. I don't think I have to elaborate, in the hands of a communist government or any other government.
Any other
But
government.
it's also, it's also brilliant because it does play on one of the most fundamental mechanisms, psychological mechanisms we have, which is gamification. Look that one up. And this is a concept that people are talking about as a way of rewarding good behavior and punishing bad behavior. You make it into a game, and you can get entire swaths of people, most of the population, going along and getting excited because they're getting points. It seems like a great thing until you realize it's being steered in a certain direction. So this is the context of demonetization of the 500 and 1,000 rupee notes. It may not seem that big on the surface, but then you start to dig into it and you start to find that there are links to, for example, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which has been pushing the cashless society. For example, back in November of 2016, as this was all unfolding in India, you have stories like this from the Times of India. Bill Gates backs demonetization, says it's worth the pain. And it goes on to talk about how the foundation has invested $1 billion in India, and he's very optimistic. And even if one of my ideas contributes to making a difference in the lives of 1.3 billion Indians, blah, 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 all the feel-good rhetoric you would
Yeah,
expect. But
sure.
why is he so particularly keen about demonetizing certain cash notes and bringing in cashless payment systems? Could it be about the control, or is it, or are we expected to believe that this billionaire only has the interests of the poor population of India in mind? I'll leave you to decide for yourself.
So, how many years before Prime Minister of India put this plan out, how many years before they were planning it? I mean, Bill Gates and the other companies involved in it. Because I know there was
That's a
one
good
company
question.
giving the digital infrastructure, one company, I mean, there was a few companies joining together to make some dough here. How many years
Well,
you
you raise
think?
a good
Yeah.
Yeah, you raise a good point because this is not something that happened on a
Exactly.
particular day, a certain moment in time. This is obviously part of a much broader agenda that's been developing for a number of years. And there may be a precise answer to that. If there is, I don't certainly don't know it off the top of my head. But I
Correct.
would say it has been in the works for years.
Yeah.
And I did point to a talk. I want to say it was at the Saudi Arabian conference the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia was throwing just before he threw all his brothers and cousins and what have you in jail.
It's
in
fucking
it was
mad.
a
It's a mad
yeah,
world.
where he was announcing NEOM, the city of the future, and all of this. Saudi Arabia is going to be the cutting edge of the future and all of this. I believe it was at that conference where there was an Indian, I believe the finance minister, that was
When
talking
was
about the
it?
cashless.
When was it?
I'm going
About.
to say 2017, summer of 2017. I'd have to look it up, but
No, no, it's fine. It's
I
fine. It's fine.
with this information, I'm sure you can find it. Indian finance minister talking at the conference, talking specifically about cashless payments and how India is going to be the leader in this. And he was talking about the various companies that are working with the government and the programs that they're developing to foster this. So it is, it's not certainly not something that's just one day, one decision. It's clearly part of an unfolding agenda.
You know, I used to live in India for many years. I used to study Indian classical music and did some Vipassana. And I have, how to say, I really love the Indian people, you know? Their heart is really good and they're really kind. I'm not talking about the other stuff that's going on everywhere, but as a nation, they're really good people. And I'm thinking, because they are so naive, how easily they fall into this trap and believing the government, believing that the 500 and 1,000 notes are really not that good and we need to give them back to the government and they will give us cashless or digital money, and how easily they fall into this trap. And on top of that, I remember, I think it was also in your report, when you said that the banks, the Central Bank of India, they now, with this special app or software, people in remote villages who have a smartphone, they can actually lend money to their uncle or niece that don't have a smartphone, and they can be used as a mini bank in a remote village to get, let's say, my niece, she wants 100 rupees. I give her 100 rupees and I get from the bank, I don't know, half a rupee for each transaction. So actually they encourage people to make a bit of money. You know, we're talking about, you know, really rupees and half of rupees, just to advance this digital money system. And this is like, again, using the goodwill of people because they want to help their family members so they can buy sugar and buy milk and buy coconut and whatever. And at the same time, they're falling into this trap prepared by the government and obviously Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, as well as other companies
And others,
and
yes,
others, yes.
miscellaneous others. But you're exactly right, and this is an important point about any, I think, large agenda item. They can't simply shove it down the public's throat. There has to be some sugar, some candy coating to this poison pill, or else who would want to swallow it? And in this case, in India, you have vast swaths of the population, a large number of people, who are not banked. They do not have access to the very basic services that you and I take so completely for granted that we don't even think about them. You have a bank account, you can make deposits and take money out. You could even get credit extended if you're, you know, if you're jumped through the right hoops. These people have no access to any of that. All they operate in is cash. And so they're going to springboard right over the system of having to go to a bank and do branch banking or whatever. You know, that's outdated nonsense anyway. Let's get them into the 21st century. If they can afford a simple phone, now they can be banked through this digital network. And all they're going to have to do, of course, is give up their fingerprints and their face scans and whatever to the government and use the cashless payment systems that are, of course, completely controlled and surveilled by the Indian Finance Ministry, as part of, you know, they got to take their pound of flesh, they got to take the taxes, and it'll be a great system for everyone. Win-win, right? And to a certain extent, yes, I mean, the people who are unbanked suddenly go into the situation where they can send and receive money and maybe even get credit. That genuinely is a boost to their lives. But what are they giving up in order
The
to
price,
gain
yes, the
that?
price they pay, yes. And I'm thinking why I asked before about how much time it was thought of and prepared, because people tend to forget. They think when we introduced, like with a new idea like cashless society or digital money or Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, they think, oh, this is great. Listen, guys, it's been planned. I mean, someone was thinking about it for many years, and there were, like, how you say, thinking groups, you know? They got a lot of money. They got paid a lot of money just to think about it and to plan it in such a way that most people will accept it and actually want it. And this is also, sorry for jumping, but even Agenda 21, you know, the big plan for humanity or world nature, etc., for the 21st century, the main thing here that people would like to have it, would like to implement it, would like the changes in their life according to the plan. Without that, it won't work. And I'm thinking now, I don't know if you're aware of, there's a researcher named Dean Henderson. He's from the Ozarks, from the States. And I've done few interviews with him. Very interesting guy. You should look him up. And he's done like a blog post, and also we did an interview about 5G and cryptocurrency. I mean, the combination, and it's going there. And I'm sure we will have also another, like, you and me, small podcast about 5G. But if you can just touch on this subject, how, in your opinion, the digital money or cryptocurrency or Bitcoin, again, whatever name you give it, how it's related or how it's going to be related to 5G or to digital surveillance system?
So what we're looking at is an interlocking series of technologies that will come together into a much broader system And not looking at any one particular piece of that doesn't give you the full picture.
We need
So
to be
5G is related to the Internet of Things idea, which is related to the smart grid, which can be incorporated with some sort of digital currency, some sort of nationally issued digital currency, to create an interlocking web of data, essentially, that's constantly flowing from you to points outside of you at all times, so that everything that you do, every object that you interact with, will be broadcasting that information to relevant authorities. Now, this, I mean, again, people have a hard time wrapping their minds around what this really means, and I can say that because there are people putting surveillance devices in their own homes. I'm talking about Nest. I'm talking about Amazon Echo. I'm talking about Alexa. All these devices that are surveillance devices that we know are surveillance devices and are recording what you are doing and saying and to broadcast. We know they are broadcasting that information back to corporate headquarters. We know that everything that gets broadcast through the internet is being intercepted and scooped up by the NSA. We know that from NSA whistleblowers themselves. So, I mean, people know that they are being watched. That's kind of the fascinating part about this that you touched on with the psychology. Because 60, 70 years ago, that was literally sci-fi nightmare
Absolutely.
Tyranny. 1940, 1984 is all about, you know, here's the telescreen, it's watching you at all times, and, you know, everyone knows it's kind of a tyranny, but you gotta look happy on the outside. Well, now we're inviting Big Brother into our homes. We're paying to have Big Brother brought into our homes. It's mind-boggling to
Too
me.
much.
And
I mean,
look, I'm not on a high horse here. I've got this device that sits on. I've got my smartphone, of course, like everyone else. That's a surveillance
I
device.
don't.
That's
I have a look.
good for you.
I have
I
this
uh
one, you know. I have
I continue to say that my next phone will be a flip phone.
I'm
But
thinking actually to throw it away. I'm thinking just look what I have here. I don't know if the cable will do. You see,
yes, imagine that. Yeah, having an actual phone.
I'm working with that landline with speakerphone. I'm good, man. I'm good.
Yeah, but we're talking through Skype, owned by Microsoft. Bill Gates is for the company, of course. So again, it is a web. It is a worldwide web, and we can say that knowingly. So, but again, it is strange to think about how enmeshed we're getting in this web, often willingly, often paying for this surveillance technology. But the 5G network, essentially, I mean, beyond other than the health effects and the fact that it can be weaponized as a type of microwave radiation weapon against the population, which are important points, don't get me wrong, I'm not dismissing that. But I'm saying the reason why it is being pushed so hard right now, or at least I think a key reason, is that it enables this Internet of Things reality that is being brought into our view, that we're being made to actually desire. Won't it be great when every object is communicating with every other object constantly and broadcasting information? There, then we can have the self-driving cars, and we can have blah blah blah, and remote surgery. I ask people to keep note when you're watching anything pimping the Internet of Things, how many times they talk about remote surgery. 5G, I've noticed specifically. There's all sorts of stories. You know, surgeons will be able to operate on you from thousands of miles away. I don't know. I'm almost 40 years old. I've never had that experience in my life where I've needed a surgeon 1,000 miles away to operate on me. I don't know how vital this is to our existence as a species, but
But you know,
anyway.
also the autonomous cars. I mean, according to some experts, this is a hoax because each car will generate so much radiation, and you multiply this by so many cars on the roads, no one will be able to drive one, to sit in one, and to read his paper or to go and look on his smartphone, because people will just get sick just from the radiation of the cars. So it won't happen. It's just to make us
Yeah, but
believe.
that won't happen overnight. It will happen gradually as people are steeped in that, and it will ramp up at a certain point. And who knows, we might get certain government reports about, oh, there's a new bioterror weapon that the shadowy terrorists have released that's killing everyone and it's causing cancer. Yes, that's what's causing cancer. So there are many ways to play with that as well, unfortunately. So this is the reality that we're moving into. I guess if we can underline the conversation, I would say I would w urge people not to conflate cryptocurrency and digital currency and national digital currency and decentralized cryptocurrency, Bitcoin and Bitcoin Cash and all of these things. They're not all the same, and we should be aware of that because I do still believe that there is a space for the use of some sort of digital cryptocurrency as a tool, one of many financial tools, to a free and aware public who know what it is they're doing and why they're doing it, specifically because it does present a way around the central bank system. Sure. But only if you were aware of that, and only if you're using it for that purpose, and only if you know how to do that. And that isn't easy. It certainly isn't easy at this point. In any system that has ever been set up through history, the easy path will always be compliance. If you comply with the authorities, you will be able to ride that easy path. There will be no bumps in the road. If you try to find a way around the system, there's going to be, of course, a lot of agents that will come out of the matrix to stop you. So that's essentially the point here. I'm not against cryptocurrency as an idea. I am against national digital currencies where the government is literally monitoring every single transaction as it's happening and has it tied directly to your ID, which is also your face scan and your fingerprints. That is the nightmare system.
Yeah.
So to the extent we're steering in that direction, I want no part of it. But I still think there's a space for free humanity to come together and to utilize technology. Technology can be a good thing.
Sure.
If we know what we're doing and why we're doing it and know about electromagnetic radiation and things like that, if we understand those problems and can work around them. But unfortunately, as you know, it's a small sliver of the population that is working towards those.
And governments are actually pinpointing these types of population so to minimize their abilities to act and to be free. And I'm you're saying there's a place for small space to have this, and I'm thinking I want to make it bigger. I want to make this space bigger so people will be more free, more aware, with more knowledge about what they're doing, what they're putting in their houses, what can harm them and their kids. And this is what I'm, you know, really working for and striving for, to let people know. This is why I'm interviewing you, so people will know about the risks or dangers or the agenda behind cryptocurrencies, bitcoins, blockchain, etc. Although it may started as a good thing, obviously it's going towards against centralized money system, so it doesn't really matter. There's not much difference. Just this is, you can feel it, and this is digital, you know, you can't feel it, but it's still not yours. It's still not in your hands. They can take it away from you, and then what you do? You cannot buy, you know, food. You cannot buy. You have to grow everything, which is always actually recommended.
Yeah.
if you can.
I guess my final message would be that I don't know who or what Satoshi Nakamoto was or is, and I, you know, no one I think really does, except for Satoshi and maybe his associates or its associates, but I do know that the vision that was talked about in that original white paper was a vision specifically refuting the system, the collapse that we'd seen in 2008, the Lehman collapse, the financial crisis, the central banks causing the problems that we were seeing. It was basically a rallying cry. We want to get away from that, and here's an idea for how to do that. And that message, whether or not Satoshi Nakamoto meant it or it was all a ploy, a psyop, whatever, there were a lot of people drawn to that message because there are a lot of people who are looking for that path and are trying to find a way around the system. And I want to encourage that. There are developers and people who know about this technology in much greater degree of technical detail than I do, who actually can influence this space. And I want to, you know, see if there is still space within the cryptocurrency space generally for that idea. Is anyone still interested in pushing that, or are people just going to go along to get along and know your customer and all of that? It is a decision that's being made right now, and unfortunately, fewer and fewer people seem to be coming out on the right side of that equation, but we'll find out.
Do you have Bitcoin, by the way?
I do. I have several cryptocurrencies. People can donate cryptocurrency to me on my front, on my page. There's in the sidebar, so I certainly do have it. I don't use it. That's another thing, but I have it.
I think, first of all, let me say thank you. It's great to have the opportunity to pick your brain, you know, with all the stuff you know, because I love the fact you see the bigger picture and you can connect the dots. And this is so important nowadays because people don't tend to do it. And also with the technologies we have, you know, the smartphones and everything, it's even getting worse. People are very stuck in specific idea. They cannot connect the dots. Even just to the degree of they talk about diapers and they see an advertisement for diapers and they don't make the connection. And so it's even to that extent, you know. So thank you very much for the opportunity to pick your brain a bit about the Bitcoin subject. Will be great if you can send me your website, a bit of like some of your bio at least, so people can read about you and other things that you think are important. Ladies and gentlemen, the Corbett Report, excellent, excellent website, excellent material. Thank you very much, James, and I'll be in touch with you for future interviews.
Okay, looking
Looking
forward
up,
to it.
yeah, looking forward for 5G one actually, because it's very hype, and you know, it's we should do one about that. So once you put it out, by the way. Because you say you're working on a report now, right, about 5G. Once you put it out, if you can send me, so I can spread it around on my
I should say
circles.
that report will debut at the Red Pill Expo in Hartford, Connecticut on June 7th through 9th.
June
And
7th.
that's at redpillexpo.org. I won't be physically there in Hartford. I will be sending them my video presentation, but that's where you can see it first, and then eventually it will end up on my website.
Well, soon you'll be able to send your hologram. Anyway.
Yeah, there you go.
Cheers, James. Thank you very much. Talk to you
Thank
soon.
you.
Bye bye.
Yep.